Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, facilitating and not hating from our studio in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined, as always, from Tallahassee by our Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Hiya, George.
And by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor, Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
All right. Well, pumpkin spice lattes are for sale at Starbucks. Postseason baseball is on TV, and the absentee ballots are in the mail. It is autumn in Florida, and election season is in full swing. Let's start right off with just a little overview of some of the latest polls. We have a love-hate relationship with polling on this show. We're kind of addicted to them, but we're also try to maintain a wary skepticism of them. But, you know, if you may remember last week, we talked about in the nationally watched Florida governor's race between Democrat Andrew Gillum and Republican Ron DeSantis. We mentioned that all the polls showed Andrew Gillum ahead. Well, this week, the DeSantis campaign called the media's attention to three recent polls. So, John Kennedy, I guess that means what? Did they finally find some polls where Ron DeSantis is ahead?
That's kind of the story, I guess. You know, in the governor's race, the tracking site, Real Clear Politics, still has Gillum up by an average of 3.7% in all the polls over DeSantis. But this week, DeSantis found three new polls, the best known being Mason-Dixon, that showed him, showed Gillum up by only about 1%. So, you know, Democrats have been boasting about the size of Gillum's crowds and mocking DeSantis for having no policies and no people at his events and poor operations. But he seems to be hanging in, at least according to the polls.
To be clear, so the polls that the DeSantis folks were calling our attention to don't actually show DeSantis leading, right?
No, no. But I guess they are, you know, largely within the margin of error where Gillum's lead is basically a toss up. But yeah, DeSantis was being scoffed at by many by sending out a press release saying he's losing, but not as much, you know. But this race has never really strayed very far from being within the margin of error in most polls.
It's not over yet, I would say. That's my expert opinion from covering politics in Florida here for a long time.
You're also seeing DeSantis and, you know, his allies, they've been, you know, keeping a pretty steady line of attack on Gillum, mostly over his $1 billion corporate income tax increase, an FBI investigation of the city of Tallahassee government, and basically just saying that he's too extreme for Florida. So, you know, DeSantis can be seen as pretty extreme right. He's opposed a lot of federal spending that actually helped Florida through the years. But this race, you know, it's probably going to come down to which side is most fired up to vote. And I don't think you're going to see much of a surge by either side in the next month.
All right. We'll revisit some more of that later in the podcast and in the coming weeks. And also then Florida's other big marquee, nationally watched, expensive race is the U.S. Senate contest between three-term Democratic Senator Bill Nelson and his challenger, Republican Governor Rick Scott. There's a Mason-Dixon poll out in that. Zach Anderson, you've taken a look at it. What jumps out at you in some of the latest polling in the Senate race?
Well, Nelson in the Mason-Dixon poll is up by just a point, 47 to 46. So it's within the margin of error. I mean, it's pretty much a dead heat, which is where it's been for the last few weeks. You know, Nelson has surged a little bit after Scott was leading early on in the race. One interesting thing about the Mason-Dixon poll in that race is that the pollster Brad Coker brought up the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination battle. And this poll was out in the field while that was going on. And he noted that, quote, the Supreme Court battle is now casting a shadow in Florida. He thought that one reason that you know, maybe Scott is hanging in there as Nelson appeared to be surging, is that, you know, Republicans might be a little bit more fired up now to defend Kavanaugh, that this whole hearing has sort of upset the GOP base. They don't think that Kavanaugh has been treated fairly. There was an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that came out yesterday that said the enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats, you know, Democrats were really fired up to push back against Trump. And in July, the enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats who said the election was very important was 10 points in favor of Democrats, but that's down to 2 points now. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it seems like the GOP base has sort of woken up a little bit with this Kavanaugh fight, and at least in the short run. I don't know how that'll play in the long run, but it could impact some of these Florida races if Republicans are more fired up to vote.
Sure. Yeah, you know, one other thing that I noticed in that Mason-Dixon poll is President Trump's approval rating in Florida. I think it was 46% approved, 48% disapproved, basically a wash.
Right. So a lot of people thought that Trump would really be driving this election to some degree, and that, you know, you go back 6 months, 9 months, and his approval ratings were down in the 30s nationally and in the low 40s in Florida. But he seems to be holding his own right now.
Right. So, it seems like he's motivating both sides, I guess. Essentially, according to Brad Coker, who always writes a good polling memo, kind of a wash as a factor in the in that race. Well, all interesting. And, you know, all that talk about numbers makes me think that I'm hearing some kind of funky royalty free music. And listeners to the podcast recognize that music. That means it's time for our pick a number segment. I hope each of you guys has brought a number. I've brought a very robust number. But let's see what you guys have. Zach Anderson, what's your number?
I'm keeping it simple, George. Sometimes we can get a little bit too complicated. I'm getting simple here today with a 2.
2? Simple and elegant. That's the only even prime number, I believe. Okay. Zach Anderson with a 2. John Kennedy, what's your number?
Yeah, I think I'm going to follow Zach's lead there, and mine is pretty simple, too. Mine is 5.
Number 5, okay.
Number 5.
Also a prime number. Well, I'm kind of way off the res on this, fellas, because I've got a number that has both a comma and a decimal point in it. I hope you're ready for this, and all you note takers especially, get ready. My number is 5,764.5.
I can't wait to hear the explanation on that.
That's right, listeners, and you're going to want to stay to the very end of the podcast. Just to review, Zach Anderson going low with a 2, John Kennedy with a 5, and George Bennett, that's me, 5,764.5. Those are the numbers. You want to hang on to the end and find out what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get right back to our show. All kinds of interesting stuff happening in the final weeks of an election in America's largest swing state. One thing I noticed, all over the country, former President Barack Obama has released a big list of endorsements. I think it might be hundreds of endorsements overall, all kinds of Democrats up and down the ticket and in most of the states in America. And in Florida, I believe his list included 18 or 19 candidates, ranging from Andrew Gillum in the governor's race and Bill Nelson in the Senate race, down to even some congressional races and some state house races. Zach Anderson, you've looked at that list. Tell us who's on the list, and maybe even more interestingly, who is not on the list.
Yeah, you mentioned a few of the candidates who are on the list. Gillum, obviously, Bill Nelson, the two top of the ticket races. You go down a little bit. There's 5 other congressional candidates who are on the list. And then he went all the way down to the state house and state senate races. There was somebody over here, Margaret Good, who won kind of a bellwether seat in a February special election. He endorsed her, gave her a little bit of a boost.
That's a state house race, right?
Yeah, that's a state house race. So his lists are pretty long, and he goes down into some of the down ballot races. But one interesting aspect is that 2 of the most competitive congressional races in the whole state, District 16 here in Southwest Florida, and the district over in the Miami area, he didn't endorse the Democrats in those races, and people are kind of scratching their heads trying to figure out why. David Shapiro, Democrat, who's raised a bunch of money to take on Vern Buchanan, a 6-term congressman in this area, didn't get an endorsement. And Donna Shalala, down in Miami, the former University of Miami president, who is running in, you know, maybe the seat that the Democrats are most hopeful of picking up. Obama didn't get behind her, which is kind of odd.
Interesting. Well, interesting on a couple levels. One, that this guy that was, leader of the free world for 8 years is now kind of mucking around in state house races in Southwest Florida. But as you mentioned, the omissions are interesting. I know you're more versed in that Buchanan-Shapiro race, but that's a competitive race, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say it's probably the top three or four competitive races in the state. And the Shalala race is probably number one in terms of the seats that Democrats hope to flip in Florida. It's a seat that Hillary Clinton won by 20 points. You have a Republican who retired, who was able to hold on to that seat, I think partly through sheer force of personality and connection to the community. But it really is a Democratic seat when you look at the partisan breakdown. And so, you know, you would think that Democrats are pouring everything into that. So to not have Obama get behind the candidate is unusual.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, I know over in this part of the state, the Palm Beach Treasure Coast area, South Florida, Lauren Baer, who is a Democrat challenging Republican freshman Brian Mast in a congressional District 18, that's Palm Beach County, Northern Palm Beach County and the Treasure Coast. She made the list. And that's one of those races that is maybe not the top tier of competitive races for Democrats, but definitely a very competitive race, especially if, you know, they're depending on how national trends go. That's certainly a winnable seat for Democrats. And so the president got behind her. But as you mentioned, Donna Shalala, that's a district in Miami where Ileana Ross Layton and the Republican is retiring. And so it's an open seat. And it's a district that Hillary Clinton won. I don't have the numbers, but I think Hillary Clinton won
20.
That district by By 20, is that what you're saying?
Okay. Yeah, I think it was 20.
Shalala, of course, was a member of the Bill Clinton administration. Is this a sign of you know, a little bit more friction between the Obama and Clinton wings of the party?
I'm not sure. That occurred to me. Yeah, she was, what, HHS secretary before she was University of Miami president. I do know in that race, some Democrats have been underwhelmed by her throughout the year, just that they, you know, saw this as a slam dunk pickup opportunity, to mix metaphors, and polls and other indications suggest it's kind of competitive, more competitive than Democrats thought, and so I don't know if that factors into it, but that's interesting. And you know, just a couple other quick notes on aside from former President Obama, just other presidential candidates, past and future, perhaps, involved in Florida. Hillary Clinton is coming into the state, I believe it's October 23rd, to campaign for Andrew Gillum. Now, remember, Andrew Gillum, in 2016, Andrew Gillum endorsed Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders in the primary, but this year, Bernie Sanders endorsed Gillum in the Democratic primary for governor, and that was a big factor in his victory in that crowded primary. And I know, anecdotally, at least, some Bernie Sanders folks are not pleased to have Hillary Clinton, the embodiment. They see her as the embodiment of the Democratic establishment. To have her coming down campaign for Andrew Gillum has upset a few Sanders folks. I don't know that that'll dampen Democratic turnout or enthusiasm. It might fire up a few Republican voters if they're not engaged already in the race, just to see Hillary Clinton coming down for the Democrat. And then, you know, a couple, just one potential 2020 candidate. Remember, we mentioned before in the podcast, if you're a Democrat thinking of running in 2020, you want to be visible during the 2018 midterms, especially in key states like Florida and Iowa and places like that. And so Michael Bloomberg, the former New York mayor, who is perennially mentioned as a potential presidential candidate, he's going to be in South Florida this weekend. He's doing a gun control event in Broward County near the site of the Parkland massacre, and then also keynoting the Palm Beach County Democratic Party fundraising dinner in West Palm Beach. So who knows what Bloomberg's going to do, but certainly remaining visible in a key state leading up to the 2020 election. So moving on, you know, we've talked quite a bit in some of the past podcasts about red tide and about blue-green algae and red tide, and those are emerging as big issues in both the governor and Senate races and some of the other congressional races and other races around Florida. And Andrew Gillum was in Sarasota County this recently. Zach Anderson, you covered that event. Tell us a little bit about what Andrew Gillum was doing in that part of the state.
So he came to Siesta Key, which is one of the areas that has been hardest hit by red tide. Lots of dead fish and other sea life washing up on the beach recently. It's kind of cleared up a little bit as we've had an east wind, and there wasn't any red tide signs when he was there. But he came there as part of, I think, a broader push to roll out his environmental plan. He put out an 8-page environmental plan, and he put out a TV ad focused on environmental issues, which are really dominating as we go down the stretch here in this election. There was actually a poll in the local congressional district that was released today, District 16. I just mentioned Vern Buchanan and David Shapiro, and it found that the environment was the number one problem that people saw in the district. 22% of people thought the environment was the number one problem behind healthcare and immigration. So you could see that this is top of mind for people, especially in this area, but it's spread all over the state. I think over where you are, George, in Palm Beach County, there's red tide now. There's red tide up by where John is, up in the panhandle. It's a very unusual event to have red tide basically encircling the whole state.
Yeah, you know, when you talked about red tide last week and you know, your personal experience being able to smell it when you walked out of your building and stuff, and I thought, yeah, that's pretty interesting. But then the red tide came over here where I live, so now now it is a big deal. So yeah. And I think Thomas Cordy, our very versatile sound engineer, has a clip, I believe, from Andrew Gillum speaking at that event you covered. Let's roll that.
We got to be very clear. We cannot allow Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis to become election year environmentalists. We're not interested in that. They have had the opportunity.
Yes.
In my opponent's case, for 6 years in Congress to do right by the state of Florida.
Right.
In the case of Governor Rick Scott, he's had 8 years.
Amen.
He turned the reins of environmental protection over to the biggest polluters in this state. Our water, our air, our oceans, all of this have been compromised under Republican control.
Now, Zach, two questions for you. First of all, in that poll, you mentioned that environmental issues are top of mind, and you're over in a pretty Republican part of the state. What is your sense of who do voters blame for that, or how would that translate at the in the election, the concern about the environment?
Well, you hear Gillum definitely trying to pin the blame on Republicans, and there's been some pressure on Rick Scott. You know, he's been the governor now for going on almost 8 years, and he's rolled back some environmental regulations during that time period. And so I do think that, you know, that is a potent issue that Democrats are trying to use against Republicans this year. In the case of Gillum's opponent, DeSantis, he's been kind of out in front on this issue. I don't know that it's going to be as easy for Gillum to paint DeSantis as anti-environment because, you know, during the primary, he was up against Adam Putnam, and Putnam was really getting a lot of support from the sugar industry. And DeSantis has been a critic of the sugar industry. So he was, you know, saying that Putnam is the errand boy of big sugar and that he's going to crack down on their pollution. He even told me that he's open to new regulations on fertilizer runoff and things like that. So I'm not sure who has the upper hand. Typically, Democrats, I think, are sort of viewed as maybe a little bit more environmentally, protection oriented. But in this race, I think both of the candidates are making a big play to be the one who is out front on the environment.
And now we mentioned DeSantis has already taken the constitutionally required airboat ride in the Everglades. Has Gillum been out on an airboat yet?
Not to my knowledge. And DeSantis has also been over here at least twice. I've interviewed him twice. He was down in Fort Myers with an event in with Sean Hannity. Near the Caloosahatchee River, which has gotten a lot of blue-green algae discharges from Lake Okeechobee, and that's been a big problem. And then he was in Englewood, when the red tide was really bad, like a month ago, and I interviewed him then. So he's come over here to talk about red tide. He's definitely been out in front on the issue. And Gillum, this is the first time I've seen him do an environmental event in this area. I think it was something that they felt they had to address. It was probably an appropriate time to address it as it spreads off to the East Coast and and really becomes even more of a huge problem in the state.
That's
good timing for them to get their environmental plan out. I think DeSantis put his out 3 weeks ago, so he was a little bit ahead of Gillum on this. There's other stuff that they're talking about other than red tide. You know, they both of them, there's some similarities actually in their plans. Both of them want to ban fracking for oil and gas in the state. Both of them want to ban offshore drilling. One of the more interesting differences is on climate change. Gillum is a little bit more aggressive about trying to address climate change. He would institute a renewable portfolio standard in the state, which would force electric utilities to get a certain percentage of their energy from renewable sources that don't emit carbon into the atmosphere to warm the planet. DeSantis told me when he was in Englewood recently that, you know, he didn't really think that the state could do much to address climate change, that he thought that that was more of a national or a global issue. So more of a contrast on that. But both of them are talking the talk about trying to reduce runoff that feeds red tide. So, you know, a lot of similarities, but a few pretty key differences.
And see, with Gillum, too, it's kind of interesting because he's basically in a position where, once again, if he's elected governor, he's going to go up against a Republican-heavy legislature. What he's proposing on climate change, it looks very similar to what former Republican governor Charlie Crist once proposed a dozen years ago. Crist was looking to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Florida and had a cap and trade plan to push companies to reduce these harmful emissions. And while the Republican legislature very warily went along for a while, by 2010, this is like 4 years into Chris's years as governor, and when he was controversially trying to run for U.S. Senate after abandoning the Republican Party, he caught more heat for this. And the legislature began rolling back some of these climate change initiatives. And of course, once Governor Scott got elected, with a focus totally on jobs, by 2012, all of Crist's climate change policies were gone.
Interesting. Yeah. So definitely some past echoes in the environmental discussion. But I wanted to, you mentioned Rick Scott and jobs, and I want to talk briefly about the U.S. Senate race, and specifically Rick Scott and Bill Nelson debated for the first time. You might have missed it. Rick Scott and Bill Nelson had a Senate debate. Tell us about your effort to see that, Zach Anderson.
Yeah, so the debate was on Telemundo, and I know you covered it, George. You were in the studio. That was probably the best way to hear it, because it was pretty hard for most Floridians to access it. You know, it was on Spanish TV. They did the debate in English, but then they dubbed it over in Spanish. So I turned on the TV to look for it when it aired, and it was in Spanish. I mean, I needed a translator for the translator. You know, it wasn't widely available in English on other stations. So it's just kind of odd that, you know, there's not a lot of people in this state who, you know, necessarily Spanish is their first language. You know, I mean, there's a significant number in South Florida, obviously, and in a few parts of the state. But for many other folks, they weren't really able to listen to this debate. And I think there's only one other debate. So it's odd that it wasn't made more widely available to in English language.
Sure. And then, yeah, John Kennedy, tell us a little bit about the skirmishing over this other debate. It's going to be on CNN on, I think, October 16th.
Yeah. They've been squabbling over this by email, and this is the second and last debate. It's scheduled for October 16th in Tampa, and to be broadcast live by CNN, but at 10:00 at night. And that's up against Major League Baseball's, you know, league championship series, and it's also the opening night of the NBA for those who are looking forward to that. Nelson's office this week tried to get CNN to reschedule it to earlier in the evening. And that kind of launched the Scott campaign into accusing him of trying to get out of the debate. And social media sort of interpreted Nelson's claim that it was too late as being too late for him. He just turned 76, and 65-year-old Rick Scott has been using terms like confused to describe his, you know, his opponent, to trying to play that age card very heavily in this race. It's funny because just in the wake of this back and forth, the Florida Alliance for Retired Americans, which is a Democratic leaning organization, attacked Scott, saying that he's using code words and what they called inflammatory ageism against Nelson.
Interesting line of attack. I'm curious what you guys think. I mean, Florida has obviously, everybody knows it's a huge state for retirees. You have a much older population. I don't know if calling somebody old and confused is necessarily the most effective line of attack.
Anecdotally, living here in the condo belt in South Florida, there have been times when you go to Kings Point or Century Village, which are these retiree communities, sometimes those folks are some of the harshest about wanting to have a young person in there. You know, I mean, like when Robert Wexler was the tremendously popular congressman here, it was said that he kind of, they all saw him as their grandson. So, but I agree with you. In a state like Florida, it's very risky to be playing the age card too much. Well, you know, in the Senate debate, I just want to play one or two clips from that to give you a little flavor of what it was like. This is just one exchange from the Nelson Rick Scott debate.
What I would do is raise the minimum wage to $12 at least, if not $15, to raise the income level so people can pay for the necessities of life and feed their families.
Thank you so much, Senator. How would you answer to that, Governor Scott?
I think this is an example of why we need term limits. Senator Nelson has been there. He's had 42 years to do something about this.
There were a lot of exchanges like that in the debate in which Bill Nelson would raise some issue, and Rick Scott would return to the fact that basically Bill Nelson has been in Washington or been in office for a really long time. He mentioned 42 years. It's Bill Nelson was first elected to the state house in Florida in 1972. And over the last 46 years, he's held some type of office for 42 years. And he's been in Washington maybe close to 30 of those years. And some other times we're holding state offices. So you'll variously hear Rick Scott mention again and again that, you know, he's been there 40 years and he hasn't done anything about XYZ problem. I want to play two other clips. This is about the issue of algae and red tide.
The algae problem is 100% tied to the fact that Senator Nelson does a campaign ad in 1990 said he's going to deal with the algae. And now how many years later, he has never done anything to get some money to fix the dike at Lake Okeechobee, which is a 100% federal project.
Okay, that's Rick Scott. And the reference to 1990 is Bill Nelson did do an ad about algae problems or problems with Lake Okeechobee in 1990 when he was running for governor. And he didn't win that race. But Rick Scott is throwing that out there to say, you know, this has been a problem for a long time, and Bill Nelson hasn't done anything about it. This was Bill Nelson's response a few moments later.
Well, I mean, we would call it a whopper, what he is saying, because it's totally disjointed from the truth. And by the way, this election is about integrity and trust. Who can you trust telling the truth?
That was kind of so Rick Scott throughout the debate was saying Bill Nelson's been in office a really long time. And Bill Nelson repeatedly was using lines like that to basically say that that Rick Scott is dishonest. And it went like that for an hour. It was John Kennedy. You were able to successfully see the debate. What takeaway did you have from it?
Well, I think it's just that level of animosity between these two candidates was really remarkable. You know, they've basically each of them calling the other a liar, and they clashed over just about every bit of policy turf, whether it's healthcare, immigration, gun control, and the environment. I mean, those seem to be the areas that they were most battling over. So this race is just going to get uglier and uglier in the closing days.
Yeah, and I just want to play two more clips really quick, and then we'll get to our pick a number segment. This is Rick Scott. They were talking about the Kavanaugh issue, and Bill Nelson was saying basically that he believes Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford. And here's a comment from Rick Scott.
Senator Nelson says he's concerned about sexual harassment claims. So his close friend, Congressman Alcee Hastings, settled a sexual assault claim for over $200,000, paid for by the taxpayers. Never once did the senator come out and say anything about it. We've got the attorney general candidate in Minnesota, Keith Ellison, that has been accused of sexual harassment claims. The senator hasn't said anything about it. Senator Nelson is a partisan politician that all he does is attack Republicans and defend Democrats.
Okay. And then here's the last clip we'll play. This is Bill Nelson towards the end of the debate going after Rick Scott.
The governor keeps coming out with one whopper after another. Apparently, you never got your mouth washed out with soap after telling a lie because you keep on going on every part of my record.
All right. I'd like to see Bill Nelson go to Burger King and order the whopper. I like the way he says that word. But that just gives you a flavor of these guys clearly do not like each other. That was my takeaway. And if you stay up on October 16th for the 10 p.m. CNN debate, you'll get to see a little more of that. Well, I hear the music playing again. There it is, funky royalty-free music. That means the podcast is nearing its end, and it's time for us to revisit our Pick a Number segment. And we're going to explain what those tantalizing numbers meant earlier in the podcast. And if I can find my notes, I don't want to trust my memory here. Zach Anderson, you had a 2. Why don't you explain that for us?
Yeah, so 2 is the number of candidates that have been on the ballot in this area who had no chance of winning because they'd already been disqualified for various reasons. Some podcast listeners might remember that I wrote about a candidate for the state legislature named Melissa Howard, who had to resign after it came out that she was touting a fake university diploma. But her name, she had to resign kind of late in the game, and her name stayed on the ballot. So she got some votes, even though they didn't count for her. And then just recently, there was a candidate for Congress named April Freeman, who tragically passed away. She had what appears to be a heart attack. And just this week, Democrats selected a replacement for her. This is Congressional District 17, which I know you're familiar with, George. It's currently held by Tom Rooney, who used to be from the Palm Beach area, and he's not running for re-election. The interesting thing about this race, so the Democrats selected a replacement for April Freeman. His name is Alan Ellison, but April Freeman's name is still going to be on the ballot because the ballots were already printed. So Alan Ellison is in the unusual position of trying to convince people to vote for him by voting for this woman who is passed away. And the crazy thing is, this is not the first time that this has happened in this district. I'm sure you remember, George, Mark Foley, who got into a big controversy when he was sending illicit text messages to underage pages in Congress, held the exact same district, and he had to resign. And then Joe Negron, who is now the president of the Florida Senate, got into the race, and he had to convince people that a vote for Foley is actually a vote for Joe. And I remember covering that race. So this is the second time this has happened, first because of illicit text messages to pages, and now because one of the candidates has died. So this race, though, is pretty overwhelmingly, this district is pretty overwhelmingly Republican. It doesn't really probably change the political calculus. It's still a big uphill climb for Democrats.
I remember that Negron race. Punch card ballots, I believe, had been eliminated, but they're still fresh in people's mind. And so I think the unofficial slogan was Punch Foley for Negron.
Yes, it was.
He did come close, but lost that race. Okay, interesting. John Kennedy, number 5. What is that?
Yeah, number 5 is the number of times that Senator Bill Nelson used the word false in reference to claims by Governor Rick Scott during their debate on Telemundo this week. At one point, Nelson summarized everything by saying, "I want to point out that almost everything that my opponent has said has been false." He was mostly referring to what he called attack ads that Scott has been airing against Nelson. But Nelson also managed to get the word lie in once and whopper, as we've heard. He got that in twice when he referred to Scott. Scott had his own buzzwords that he managed to get in there. He managed to get the word confused in twice about Nelson and wrong 3 times. So that's kind of the way it was over that scorched earth hour on Telemundo for those who got to watch it.
That's some good analysis there. Well, my number was the, I got the biggest number, as you may recall, 5,764.5. That is the crime rate in Tallahassee in 2017, where Andrew Gillum was mayor. That represents that number, 5,764.5 crimes per 100,000 residents. That was the third highest rate in Florida. You're going to be hearing a lot about, you already have heard a lot, and there will be hearing more about the crime rate in Tallahassee. Republicans are trying to tag Gillum with being the mayor of a high crime city. In 2016, Tallahassee actually had the highest crime rate of any city with 100,000 or more people in Florida. Then the crime rate went down 14% in 2017. And so the Gillum folks, you'll hear them talk a lot about how crime rate is way down. Well, it is way down, but Tallahassee is still among large cities, the third, has the third highest crime rate in Florida. So you'll be hearing a lot about the crime rate in Tallahassee, but that's the specific number, 5,764.5 per 100,000. All right. Well, that concludes yet another of our Inside Florida Politics podcast. We thank you all for listening. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. I've been assisted here in the studio by Corzano, the tag team of sound engineer Thomas Cordy and Joe Forzano. We've also had from Tallahassee State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy, and from Sarasota, Zach Anderson from the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Thank you.